Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today we are doing a mini episode on the Chester Mystery Cycle, or more specifically, a production of the Chester plays. Every 5 years, Chester puts on a production in, oddly enough, Chester, and works on a new production, a new way of producing it, because Chester is a slightly organic set of mystery plays. For those regularly listening to the podcast, we have four sort of complete texts, only two of which we could arguably say are reasonably representative of original mystery cycle practice. And Chester is the most expansive, because there are a whole host of copied manuscripts from the latter end of the cycle's existence. And the Chester cycle has cycled through a number of ways of presenting how the plays are produced. Originally a Corpus Christi play, and then they thought, no, hang on, we'll do it over 3 days over Whitsun, so we can get on with having a separate Corpus Christi pageant procession. Everything's getting a bit confused. And then the Reformation happened, and everything got thrown up in the air and got more diffuse, and they started trying to rewrite it and make it change the theology a bit, and then eventually the logic of the Reformation meant that it disappeared. But luckily antiquarians copied out various different slightly different versions of the text, of which we have various versions today. And in more recent times, the tradition of reviving new versions of these plays in a modern way has occurred, and my guest is the shepherd for this production. So my guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
I am John Young, and I am the director of the 2023 cycle of the Chester Mystery Plays.
Yes. Tell us about sort of your process of putting this on, because it happens every 5 years, but it's not exactly the same every 5 years, is it? There are different versions that have occurred over time. You've sort of got a base text you're working from by Edward Burns, but that's not necessarily what you're doing per se. So tell us about your production. What are you doing with it?
Yeah, so just. You mentioned there the text. So Ed Burns, this was a text that was first used in 1987. And Ed Burns had written this text, which went over a couple of nights. As you previously stated, that used to be a thing. They'd take the plays, because of course there are so many of them, and it's such a massive story to tell in one night. Trying to include all of these plays and the entire narrative is tricky. And that's one, of course, of the challenges that I faced. We are doing our production over one evening. And Ed Burns wrote this text, which is lovely, actually. It's quite accessible. It is, it's got quite a lot of fun in it. It's got quite a lot of humour in it. And I suppose I have adapted it. But I suppose what adaptation means in this particular instance is there's been a lot of cutting. So one of my jobs has been to try and work out what to lose and what to keep. We've ended up with 17 plays. And lots of my choices, I suppose, in terms of what to cut, has been surrounding how to make it feel like one narrative, how to make this feel like one story. So, due to the nature of the stories, it's quite episodic in terms of we have this play, we have this play, we have this play, and we have this play. Especially Act One, where you kind of go through creation into Adam and Eve, into Noah. It feels like you're jumping into different worlds, meeting different characters. The great thing about when Jesus arrives is we then follow one man through the cycle of all the things that happens to him. But before Jesus arrives on the scene, what you've essentially got is you've got, kind of God, doing all of the things that God does before Jesus arrives in the world. So Act Two is slightly easier because Jesus is the vehicle for the audience to hook onto, and we follow him through his life and his death, and of course him coming back to life again. So that's a slightly easier in Act Two, but in Act One, it does feel quite episodic, and it is episodic. It spans, quite a big period of time. Lots of things happen. There's still darkness. There's lots of joy in Act One, but of course we've got Cain and Abel, which doesn't have a happy ending by any stretch of the imagination. And I suppose for me, what what I've tried to do is I suppose I've tried to bring a bit of spontaneity to these stories. I think the difficulty with directing, we all know how this ends. The audience sit down at the beginning of the show, and let's face it, we're all waiting for the crucifixion because we know what's going to, you know, I don't have the element of surprise. I don't have the option to kind of, you know, shock the audience and go, oh, I didn't know that was coming. We all know what's going to happen. We all know when it's going to happen. And we all know what's going to happen just before that happens. So, one of the things I've tried to do is I've tried to look at how I can make it feel like these stories are happening for the first time. And I suppose that's more in the acting of it and the playing of it. But from a text point of view, you know, what that's meant is I've really tried to pull out where it feels like those decisions are being made. So, for example, when God chooses Noah and decides that, you know, God's going to flood the earth and, you know, almost start again, you know, making that decision feeling like it's happening in the moment rather than it's all pre-planned out. Because what that gives it, it just makes the story feel active. It doesn't make us, you know, I want the audience to sit down. And I want them to have a theatrical experience. This is a piece of theatre. And it's really interesting, I think, when you work on something which is rooted in religion and it's rooted in tradition, it's really interesting those ideas where, you know, you change things. But what I keep saying to people is we have to remember that this isn't a documentary. This is a piece of community theatre. And therefore, we have to be looking, you know, I haven't changed the story. I haven't added in any new words. There's no, you know, there's not a tap dance in the middle of act one. You know, there's not, I haven't changed anything. I suppose what I've tried to do is I've tried to streamline the narrative, you know, and of course in these texts, there's so many repeats. There are so many repeats. So the moment you move out all of the sections where we talk about how amazing God is, well, you've already saved yourself 20 minutes. You know, because of course, naturally in these texts, there's lots of repetition. So I think instantly the first thing was let's remove all the repetition. We don't need the repetition. We've just said that. Or, you know, we'll take a page to say something which could be said in two lines. Now, of course, you lose the beauty of the language in terms of the language thing. You lose the beauty. You know, if I've got a page of text, which is all very beautiful, there's so much color in the text. I could cut it. But I lose lots of beauty. But actually, all I need to move the story forward on that page is two lines. So in that sense, I suppose it's about playing hard and fast with it. And I suppose I've just had to make decisions, I suppose, from a directorial and narrative point of view, rather than we are all sitting down and watching a documentary.
Yes, I mean, it's that difference because you're in an indoor space. Originally, it would have been on the street. And a lot of the repetition there is partly, A, because not everybody's watching the whole cycle over the 3 days. You know, the people would have originally chosen their favorite bit. I like this one, I like this one. But also, it was shouted in the streets. And so the repetition is deliberate. So when you shift it to an indoor context, you don't need that because that line they might have missed in that stanza when the wind blew suddenly quite hard is no longer necessary. So it's that shifting of context by doing it you know, within a cathedral in a space that, you know, you have more control of the acoustic. It's not always a better acoustic indoors in a church. There are some big problems with a big echoey space. They can be very, very good for a certain kind of text performance, but they can also be a bit an interesting nightmare. And you've got, obviously, you've got a large, it's a large community production. You've got music, you've got all sorts of other production elements going in. What's the shape of the production going to be like for an audience coming in?
So a couple of things. One thing I haven't mentioned is we are actually also to add more complications to that list that you've just explained. What's amazing about the mystery plays is they are enormous. And every time I think they can't get any bigger, they get bigger. So you're right. Yeah, I've got a cast of hundreds. I've got a mini orchestra. There's a, you know, massive team of like over 30 musicians. There's a choir. You know, there's an army of stitchers and makers who are all, you know, scurrying away, making these props and sewing these costumes. And it feels like a real community pulling together to tell stories. And that is magical. It kind of doesn't get better than that. And also because people are choosing to be there. You know, I also do a lot of work with professional actors. And the difference with professional actors is they're getting paid. This is how they put food on the table. This is how they pay their gas bill. Mm. You know, they take the job sometimes because they don't want to do it, but they have to do it. Like some people have to go to work. But, you know, the gorgeous thing about making a show with a community is, you know, that's a choice. They're doing it because they love it and they're doing it because they care. Our production this year is staged in Traverse. So our stage is 30 odd meters long. We're using the entire length of the nave in the cathedral. What that means is we are a couple of things. It means it's very hard acoustically, like you've just said. Our sound designer at the moment is working out delay systems because, of course, it means that everybody's going to receive sound at different points. So how do we, there's like eight, I don't know the actual technicalities of it, but essentially there's something like 82 delay cue points that they've had to put in because, of course, they've had to work out the distance between every mic and every speaker to make sure that the audience receive the sound at the same time. It sounds very, very, very complicated, and it's all my fault. But luckily, I've got an amazing team who are kind of, you know, working really hard to make sure it sounds really beautiful. But what this, going back to the point I made about the Traverse, is what this really long space gives us is it gives us this sense of traveling. It gives us this sense of movement and this sense of journeys. And all of these stories are about leaving somewhere and arriving somewhere else. You know, within these stories, there's so much about traveling, so much about starting at one point and ending at another point. And what this means is I can literally travel these stories through the space. And also there's a really nice hark back to their origins, which is these stories would have been traveling through the city on the back of carts, you know, and everyone would receive a slightly different version of them. And what's going to happen in this production is everybody's going to receive a slightly different version of them. It's going to put the audience within the action. It's going to mean that, you know, some people are going to be in reaching distance of Jesus. It's going to mean that some people are sat 5 meters away from the crucifixion. It's going to mean that some people are sat 15 meters away from the birth of Jesus. You know, everybody, depending on where you're sat, is going to have a very, very different experience. And again, I think there's something really beautiful about that everyone, you know, you could come back and watch the show and sit in five different places and it would feel very, very different. You know, of course, my job is to make sure that it's balanced, to make sure that you don't feel like you've missed out on all the good bits if you're sat at that end, you know. But what it does mean is you can create this sense of movement. And I think what that hopefully will give me is a really nice sense of energy. It will keep the stories alive. It's not static. It's not presentational. Mm. You know, these stories are urgent. You know, we're talking about the creation of the world. You know, we're talking about, you know, the death of Jesus, the rise. You know, none of these, you know, it's dramatic. It kind of doesn't get more dramatic than this. Mm. And I think what this will hopefully give us is this will give us that sense of drama. And by making the actors not keep still, it will mean it can't get indulgent. We can't stand and talk. You know, always I say to the actors, keep moving through the space. You know, they want to have conversations right next to each other, but they can't. They have to have conversations across the space. And what that does is it makes them play out. Mm. So, you know, and they're doing incredibly well with it because it's such a skill. And some of the people that we've got in our cast have never been on a stage before. We've got a lot of actors who this is their first time on stage, because again, the wonderful thing about the mystery plays is if you want to be in it, you're in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone is welcome, and you know, they can all take part.
It's the nicest kind of casting opportunity, because it's not casting like you basically have a sorting hat. That's what you're doing. You're saying, okay, what are you most appropriate for? What can you do? Because we've got a big part, we've got small parts, we've got all the fun of the fair is there, and that's one of the really nice things about the mystery cycles generally, is that they are designed that way, so that, you know, you've got different skill sets that you can play to. Music is so central to all of these plays as well. And just on the note about traveling. I mean, there's something about so much medieval drama in general is about traveling. Yes, you will have a static wagon where, you know, maybe the big speeches are doing, but they often are using the street. They're often where else are they going to come on from? You know, there is vaguely a potential of sort of a behind the cart tiring house kind of thing, but by and large they've got to come on from someone and they've got to go away from somewhere. Yep. And so much of this dynamism for many of the medieval texts, possible exception of York, not that we're too grading York or anything. If you want a statuesque version of a mystery cycle, York is the one where you go to. But Chester is so much more dynamic, I feel. I think it's the most accessible of the mystery plays, in my opinion. I think it's the most direct and has a really lovely voice to it. Anyway, circling back to music, you have music. You mentioned a mini orchestra. Music is central to these plays. Singing, there are usually music cues throughout them. A lot of those music cues may be lost, so you can be inferring new ones and things. But yeah, you have angels and opportunities for angels to sing and already in the text. How far are you taking the music?
Yeah, really pushing the music. And actually, we've got a wonderful composer and musical director called Matt Baker, who's a bit of a Chester legend. And, you know, has this amazing ability of drawing people together and creating the most wonderful sounds. And this is Matt's fifth time. So Matt's the mystery play veteran. You know, he's really done it, which is great to have someone on the team who, you know, brings such a wealth of experience and knowledge. But one of the things I said to Matt was, you know, we sat down, I played him some references, and I think what's great musically about these plays is there's such a palette. You know, we go from these big, massive, kind of epic, you know, songs which are sung with the organ, which, you know, feel very grand, and, you know, to these tiny little sung solo lines where, you know, Mary realizes she's carrying, you know, Jesus, and, you know, in these little motifs that come back and come back again. And, you know, music's really important in drama to kind of help create tension and help create a world. And not only in the sung moments, but actually quite a lot of this stuff is underscored. Mm. Quite a lot of the text is underscored with, you know, we've got the most amazing array of instruments in this, I'm calling it an orchestra. It's a tight group of musicians who kind of all, and actually some of the actors are also in the band, as it were. So, you know, it might be that, you know, for example, Steve, we've got a chap called Steve Lincoln. He plays a soldier, and he's in lots of other crowd scenes, but he's also on the percussion. So Steve does a big bit of percussion, comes on stage, does his soldiering, and then goes back to the percussion. So it's kind of a real collective effort. But the music's really, really important. And especially in cathedrals, you know, we need to fill the space. That space can very, very, very quickly feel empty. Mm. And I suppose my job, one of the tasks I have is, how do I keep it full? How do I make sure it doesn't, you know, it's really demanding. Mm. The space is really demanding. It demands to be filled. Mm. And you're not, you know, you're filling such an enormous space. It's not a church, you know. And interestingly, we've been rehearsing in a school, and then we moved to a church hall. And what it's been really, really difficult to try and get the actors to understand that, you know, you can't be that small. You know, there's kind of not very much room for subtlety. You know, this isn't a Chekhov in a studio theatre. You know, this isn't a kitchen sink drama. And although I want some really lovely acting and some really detailed, nuanced, naturalistic choices, of course I want that. I'm a director, I'm working with a script. You know, we can't afford to be that subtle. You know, I need to see the decision. There has to be grandeur, and the performance have to be measured. And I suppose what I'm trying to do is really turn all of those dials up to make sure that it matches the space.
Yeah, so it's matching the space, matching the text. The text, as I was saying earlier, is designed to be shouted. It's very difficult to actually say mystery plays down. You have to put them up and throw them out.
Yeah.
Because that's how the text is designed to be spoken.
Of course.
You know, it's not a, you know, when some people say, oh, it's just, they're not very subtle. And going, well, they're for the street. You can't do extended metaphor and simile when you're bellowing on a street.
Exactly.
You have to get the information across. And that's why the rhyme and the alliteration is so important. And the voices, of course, because there'll be local voices. These are plays written in a local vernacular, and that sort of voice is important as well. The soundscape of these plays for the local community, as well as what they would have sounded originally.
Yeah, and I think that's I've really tried to push the locality of it. Mm. You know, we sit in a funny place in Chester because we've got Wales there, we've got Liverpool there, we've got Manchester there, but you know, it really is a bit of a buffet in terms of, you know, all of, you know, and also I'm celebrating that. We're not hiding that as would, you know, it's really, really, and actually there's something really nice about hearing that real mixture of, you know, voices. We've got a lady in the cast who's from Australia and I've, you know, great. Let's celebrate all of these different voices, and hearing the text with all of these different voices is, you know, is really nice. But one of the things I have to keep working on, and if you ask the cast, what does John keep banging on about? It'd be diction.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's again, it's really, really hard. I think we've forgotten how to talk, you know, and I you know, at the worry of sounding like an, you know, a miserable, you know, old man, you know, who kind of moans about, you know, I spend my life banging on about the fact that, you know, you have to work hard. You know, it's not something that, you know, you have to work at it. So one of the things I'm trying to get them to do is like really over engage the dialogue. Mm. And use the text. You know, again, we don't have, you know, although we've been rehearsing since January, we've been rehearsing on a Thursday and a Sunday. We don't have the time to sit down and break up all the text and go over every rhyming couplet and put all the beats in the, you know, we just don't have time to do that. And we don't, you know, it's, this production is not going to ever be that, really, you know. And some people are going to be more, you know, there are some actors who are going to be stricter on it. I suppose what I've had to do is go, okay, Do we know what it means? Are we making sense of it? Are you playing the objectives? Are you telling the story? And are you using the text? Because it's so easy to just plow through it. It's so easy to just drive through it. I suppose one of the things I've been doing is, you know, asking them to think about colouring it, asking them to think about variation, asking them to think about, you know, where the weight of certain words lies, because it can very easy, da 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 da, you know, and I've made deliberate choices to interrupt that at points. Mm. I've made deliberate choices where there may be, you know, where I've made a cut where we finish out of the rhyme and we finish just to try and interrupt it so we don't get too much into that rhythm. I've tried to make some deliberate choices where we've, you know, just broken it up a little, you know, broken it up a little bit. I haven't been massively strict with it, but again, because of the context, you can't be. What my first thing is, do you know what it means? Do you know what you're trying to do and what you're trying to say? Do you know what this bit of text is doing? Okay, this is the bit where the instruction is this. What I need you to play is this. Okay, let's go back. Now what I need you to do is use the text. You know, like you said, the alliteration thing. I had a rehearsal last night, and Duncan, who's playing our Jesus wonderfully, we were kind of just going over, and because of the way that rehearsals have been, I haven't really had the time. And we were just going over the text, just him and I, you know, we spent a couple of hours just going over the text. And it's only when you sit back and you go over it that you realize how clever all of this is, how there's so much in it. You know, again, because of the nature of rehearsals, you know, in a professional rehearsal room, I'd spend hours sat around a table going through the text. Mm. In these rehearsal rooms, we just don't have that, you know. No. we're doing it on the floor. But there's so much in there, and it's so, like I say, Ed Burns has done, it feels really accessible and also funny. You know, there's a lot of humor in there, and we need that because there isn't, you know, there's not much humor in these stories. It gets dark fast.
Yes, it does. I mean, you were saying, you know, everyone knows the story, but I assume that's because you're not doing the Balaam and Balak play. Because Chester does have these odd little moments where you're sort of going, I don't remember this story. That's the disadvantage of doing the smaller version is you don't get a talking ass.
They also have the Gobbit in the Chester plays, which is the which originally, interestingly, I was so keen on using. The Gobbit is a Chester specific kind of tool, the character who is, I suppose, it's a narrator, really. And I was so keen early on. I said, "That's it. I'm gonna, you know, it's." And in some productions, they've used it, and others they haven't. And I was quite keen on using it. But as I started getting into the text, I couldn't quite justify having time at the end of every scene for someone to then tell us what's just happened in the scene.
Yes.
When I'm trying to cut something down, I just sadly didn't have. I really wanted it. I just couldn't find the time in the running time to get that in. I wanted to because it's a lovely, and actually some of that text feels quite cheeky and it feels quite playful, but it just...
It's really, and for the listeners at home, that there is this sort of a variety of expositors, especially in the sort of first, the Old Testament end of the play, who just keep popping up and explain. And there is this specific one where it feels much more like the local dignitaries stood up and said, "Thank you very much for coming. Come back tomorrow for the next set of plays. Ale is available over there. Accessible toilets are at the back." You know, and it's so charming and it's lovely and it feels like a strange quirk of maybe, and it may not be very old. It might be something that got added quite late in the day to the text, because I say the texts keep changing and different things keep changing.
And again, probably would have been there to be, you know, like you said before, would have been there to also, you know, the bits that people didn't get, the bits that, you know, just to, again, it's that recap, isn't it? It's about that, you know, okay, to conclude, in this play, this happened, and this happened, and now we're going to go and see what happens in Adam and Eve. You know, they're linking. It's a nice recap and a link.
And I think it's also, there's an interesting question about the I think sometimes it's to do with the theology, especially with the Old Testament, where, because sometimes they don't know what to do with the theology of the Old Testament. It's going, Abraham and Isaac, what's just happened? How is this a good thing? And I think there is a genuine, even then, a genuine problem, you know, and there are a lot of Abraham and Isaac plays, the other versions as well, where someone steps up and says, "Well, it's to explain this, I'm really convincing as to my explanation as to why this play exists." And I think there is a genuine, sometimes, disconnect with the Old Testament and New Testament, that they're struggling to actually make the joins. I mean, Cain and Abel, you have a sort of Christ imagery thing going on there, so there's sort of a connection they can do there, and that there are various little ones, but sometimes they do struggle.
And I've tried to, you know, again with Cain and Abel, you know, that I've tried to make it feel like it's not, I've set up this almost domestic setting of these two brothers who are when we see them come on, they're having this race, they're racing through the cathedral. And it almost starts with an argument of these two young lads who are going, "Oh, you won again, you won again." You know, this idea of these competitive boys. Mm. And then I've tried to play around with this idea that actually, when the kind of fight takes place, I've managed to get a wonderful fight director in called Caitlin. And actually, without giving any spoilers away, there's this big fight that I want to use the entire length of the cathedral. And actually what it starts as is, you know, Cain just playing with Abel. It's not I'm going to kill you straight away. It starts with, "I'm going to teach you a lesson. I'm going to scare you."
Yeah.
And then it ends up as going too far and, you know, making that. So I've tried to kind of, you know, as any actors and directors in a room will do, we've tried to make sense of them and try and find a version of these that they can play with some kind of reality rooted in themselves. Because the next moment we have a mother who's got her dead son in her arms. You know, I think that, you know, it's really, and actually that's the kind of big bit of tragedy. And then of course we have the slaughter of the innocents a little bit to end Act One. Mm. The thing I've tried to do with all of them is just try and make sense of them for us so that the actors can feel like they've got something to play.
Yeah.
Especially because I want the audience to connect and I want the audience to feel. And they're not going to do that if we haven't worked out what the reality is for us, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I suspect we could talk all day, but sadly, we have to turn this episode around so that it goes out before the production actually happens. So those listening in the distant future, this will be in the past, but when this podcast actually drops, this is before the Chester plays actually appear. So tell us, how can people get tickets and come and see this show?
Yeah, so you can get tickets from Chester Cathedral in person if you happen to be in Chester, or you can get tickets from the ChesterMysteryPlays.com website. We start our performances very, very soon. And actually, if you look on the Chester website, it says curtain is officially up in 12 days, 8 hours and 56 minutes. Not that anyone's counting, apparently. And the performances run from the 28th of June to the 15th of July. We've got 21 performances, which is, again, for a community show, is you know, incredible that we get such a lengthy run, but you know, there's so much that goes into them. I think they want to make sure that we, you know, they can be seen, and people travel from all over the world to see these, apparently. And they've got a really big following, and it's really, really exciting. And please do, you know, come and support us, and you know, celebrate a community coming together to tell these magnificent stories in this beautiful, beautiful building.
So book now, otherwise you'll have to wait 5 years for it to come around again. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I wish you all the best. Break a leg for everybody, and hope that everything goes well. And maybe we'll have a catch up after it's all over and see you know what you learnt from it and what came out the other side. Because I'm sure there will be stories to tell. But
there will be many, I'm sure.
Thank you once again to my guest.
Thanks, Robert.
And goodbye.